Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Welcome to the Total Soccer Show and the Weekend Review. On today's show, we're talking about the start of the Africa Cup of Nations, its locations, its celebrations, and its complications. We're looking at the English FA Cup, which sent some vibrations through some Premier League teams with ideas above their stations. In Italy, Juventus made some declarations while Roma had some defensive frustrations. In Spain, Barcelona's aspirations once again didn't meet their fans' expectations. And in Germany, Borussia Dortmund gave some indications the title race might not have ceased operations. My name is Ryan Bailey. It's good to be back from vacations. And I think all of that rhymed with Africa Cup of Nations. Joining me today is a man whose voice is sweeter than a Danny Elvis cross, Mr. Taylor Rockwell. Hello, sir.
Hello. That was quite the introduction. I especially appreciate you going straight to the celebrations of AFCON because twice it seemed like we were about to get the choreographed team-wide celebration, and then it did not take off. I'm hoping that happens in the later rounds, and they're just keeping their powder dry until then.
Absolutely, and I'm delighted that I picked a word that rhymes with so many other things, like nations, this week, Taylor. Wonderful work from me.
I hear that's why they named it that. That's why the tournament is named that, so that podcast hosts can have rhyming introductions pretty easily.
For my benefit and my benefit alone, that's very good to hear. What did you think about Danny Alves coming back to Barcelona real quick, Taylor? I think pretty happy with his performance, maybe. Are you as happy as Sergiño Dest's agent about that?
We'll see. We'll see if Chelsea end up needing him, in which case he's just going to find himself surplus to requirement everywhere. But listeners to last week's shows will know that my plan for Barcelona is to bring back the treble-winning team and just have them all be coaches slash occasional players. And so, yeah, Dani Alves being back in the team, it's just one step in that direction, Ryan. One further step.
That's work for Man United.
The voice you just heard there is the man who loves an FA Cup upset possibly as much as he loves his wife and kids.
I mean, is that saying much? No, I'm kidding on.
Exactly the response I wanted, Grant. Thank you very much.
I know it was. And I obliged. How are you, Ryan Bailey?
I'm very good indeed. It's good to be back with you fellas indeed. And the fourth fella in this discussion is a man who's adjusting his circadian rhythms to Cameroonian time as we speak. Arizona Joe Lowry. AJ, how's it going?
It's going well, Ryan. I think you might be right, given it feels like I'm up in the middle of the night here. It's not that early out here in Phoenix, but it's early enough right now. Ryan, it's good to have you back. Graham, that was really funny. Taylor, I don't like your plan for Barcelona. What's up, everybody?
Well, we're putting the world to rights in the intro, it sounds like here. AJ, I'm going with, by the way, for the rest of the podcast. Hope you don't mind that. I did look up Cameroonian time. It's the same time zone that I'm in. So that's super convenient for me. Maybe not for the rest of you guys, but we shall see. Adjust your sleep cycle accordingly, Joseph. We're going to be talking about plenty on this show, including the Africa Cup of Nations, as I mentioned, and the FA Cup, which started, the third round started over the weekend, where big matches, of course, in Italy, Spain, and Germany as well. Lots to talk about here. We're going to talk about the FA Cup a little later, but I wanted to tease it, gents, if you don't mind, with the very best moment of the weekend. I don't know if you caught this.
Wimbledon losing.
Charlton versus Norwich in the FA Cup on Sunday. You probably didn't catch this game, but I saw a tweet from Aaron Flanagan of the Daily Star who sent a picture on the Twitters. Elite level poophousery from Charlton, he writes, who at halftime in the Norwich game showed extended highlights of the day Norwich were relegated from the Championship. In 2008-09. They showed it on the big screen while Norwich were visiting their stadium. And that is the best poophousery I think I've ever seen. Taylor, what do you think of that?
I mean, it's also just getting them ready for the end of this season as well. So in that way, it's a nice sort of look back and look ahead at the same time.
Well, the funniest thing is, gents, I actually looked into that season. Charlton were also relegated with Norwich that season. They were 7 points below Norwich. They were both relegated, so I don't quite know what the logic was. Also, it didn't work because Norwich went out in the second half and scored, and it finished 1-0 to Norwich, who will now face Wolves in the next round.
So, so Ryan, the best moment of the weekend wasn't Boreham Wood knocking Wimbledon out, no?
So, AFCON, why don't we get to AFCON, the 33rd Africa Cup of Nations. Thank you very much, Graham. In Cameroon, this was, of course, 24 teams, six groups of four, leading to a final round of 16, same sort of, similar sort of format to the Euros. It's on beIN Sports, Taylor. It started on Sunday. Your initial impressions of this tournament, sir?
Give me 1 second. I'm taking a brief break, and then I'll be back probably. Maybe I'm taking a hydration break. We're not entirely certain. Yeah, there were some weird breaks
there.
To this
broadcast.
I see
what you did there.
Yeah, man. and Joe, to his credit, was like, is anyone else having like a strangeness with the feed? And I think because I was sort of passively watching at the time, I just assumed it was multiple hydration breaks, not realizing that, no, it was just cutting in and out. But we didn't miss too much, I don't think, and it was a fun opener. I'm glad that Cameroon, the hosts, got the win. But yeah, a strange start to the tournament from a coverage perspective, but maybe that was to be expected given that it's been sort of a strange tournament to begin with. Cameroon supposed to host in 2019, then that was pushed back to, I think, June and July of 2021. Then they were going to move it forward to January of 2021 to avoid the monsoon season, then pushed back a year due to COVID, and now here we are. Players getting released late, lots of positive tests. I believe there is still an open conflict in certain parts of Cameroon, but all that put aside for the opening game, which the hosts won, and I'm going to assume that is the way they wanted to start this tournament.
Indeed. And a little bit more I was learning, Taylor. This actually clashes with the Club World Cup as well, the FIFA Club World Cup. And Al Ahly are going to play Monterrey in the Club World Cup on the 5th of February.
Yeah.
That's the day before the Cup of Nations final. Six Al Ahly players are in the Egypt squad. So if they're in the final, there's a little bit of conflict there, I'd say, Taylor.
Yeah, I'd say so as well. I did note that there are six Al Ahly players in the Egypt squad and six Zamalek players. Maybe that's just random, but I do like to think that those two teams, disliking each other as much as they do, you have to have a balance of players, otherwise things could boil over.
Indeed. Why don't we have a little chat about the opening game then, as you hinted at there, Taylor. Cameroon against a 2013 finalist Burkina Faso, Cameroon being the host of this tournament. They won 2-1. Two penalties from their captain, Vincent Aboubakar. Good penalties as well. Very enjoyable, Joe. What did you make of this game? My headline for this game was, that was fun.
It was. It really was. And it was weird tactically. I like to watch these games through a tactical lens. It was tricky at times to figure out what exactly Cameroon was doing. It was a little bit easier to figure out what Burkina Faso was doing because they didn't spend as much time playing with the ball as Cameroon did. From Burkina Faso, it was a lot more defending, some resolute blocks, things like that. They were in this base 4-4-2 shape, at least as I saw it defensively, that then shifted into a back five when one of the wings dropped deeper to provide some extra cover. We see that from teams around the world, especially ones that are going to be defending for large periods of time. Cameroon, though, like I said, was a little bit more confusing, and part of me thinks that's by design. With the personnel they have in the back line, they can go through a back four, they can play through a back four, or they can play through a back three, and they did both of those things in this game. The X factor, at least in that back line space, I thought was Seattle Sounders' very own Nuhu, right? He was playing this versatile left-sided fullback, center back role, and he'd be a wing back sometimes overlapping, or he'd be tucked into the back line and providing the anchor spot on the left side of that back line. And he had a huge impact on this game. He was really good defensively. He was energetic. He was mobile. He was focused in, and I thought he nailed a lot of his positioning. And then he was making some really important moves into the attack as well. He draws the second penalty in the first half, the second goal of this game for Cameroon. Essentially, he creates, and Aboubakar finishes. And I don't think we can talk really too much about Nuhu in this game, but there were other intriguing elements as well from Cameroon. At times, like I said, back three, and it looked more like a 3-5-2 with Ekambi and Aboubakar up front. Other times, it was more of a lopsided 4-3-3 or a 4-2-3-1. And really, all of those numbers are just to try and give listeners, as I tried to give myself, some framework for watching Cameroon in this game. It was very fluid, a little bit hard to pin down. And I think that made Burkina Faso's lives pretty challenging.
Yeah, plenty of players from MLS in this tournament. Nuhu, of course, arguably one of the stars of this tournament so far, if I may go so far to say that. 404 players from European-based teams as well. Graham, I said my headline for this game was fun. I think my subhead might be, chaos. within the first 40 seconds, we had a pretty wild challenge, a studs up at groin level tackle.
Yeah, I mean, it was the perfect opener for a tournament that is frequently renowned for its chaos. 40 seconds in, as you say, a tackle from Iago, Burkina Faso player. I can't really figure out why he wasn't sent off, other than obviously it happened so early in the match. But yeah, it was chaotic. Everything from, you know, Andre Onana also had a very chaotic opening 10 minutes. I do have some sympathy because this is only his fifth match since returning from a 9-month drugs ban. And this was probably the most high profile of those five matches. But you could see the anxiety in how he started the match. He obviously makes the misjudgment for the goal. By the way, that finish by Sangare at the back post was not easy at all. The technique on that was incredible. However, once Onana settled down a bit, we saw why he's so highly rated and why he'll be crucial to this Cameroon team. And in general, that was a theme for this Cameroon team. Once they kind of got a grip of the match, once Zambo and Gisa, in particular, started to take a grip of the game at the base of midfield, it just felt like Cameroon's quality kind of told in the end.
Graham, I'm with you. And Gisa in particular, I'm so glad you mentioned him. He played a little bit higher up in this game than I expected him to, and especially watching this game go on, he was playing more as an eight, you know, in front of a number six in this game. And I think as the game progressed, he started to drop a little bit deeper, or at least the game found him more. He found good spots to pick up the ball. And I thought that helped Cameroon gain more control. I mean, he does earn, the penalty in the first half that leads to Abubakar's first penalty kick goal that gets Cameroon level. But he did so many other things in the run of play in midfield, spraying passes around, driving the ball forward. And Giza's a player I really liked. And overall, Cameroon's performance in this game is something that I liked. I think they're the favorites to finish on top of Group A over Burkina Faso, over Cape Verde, over Ethiopia. I think they have the talent to make a pretty significant run in this tournament. They need to sharpen some things up in the attack, but I assume that some of that will come with game reps. But overall, in Giza and Ekambi, and I really liked Abubakar up top as the nine. You've got Nuhu covering ground on the left. There's a lot to like about this Cameroon team.
I want to talk about Abubakar, man.
Yeah, I was going to lead you there.
Those penalties, goodness gracious. The first one, very good. The second one, especially good. Watching it again and realizing that he does not look at the ball from the time he starts his run-up on that second one. He is watching the goalkeeper the entire way and then ends up looking the goalkeeper off. He feints like he's going to the side that he is actually going to, then stares at the opposite side. Goalkeeper dives in that direction. He passes it into the first side of the goal. And it was very impressive that he switches sides, but just the calmness of that finish on both occasions, that for as chaotic of a start as it was, and with Cameroon down 1-0, if that was maybe more questionable, I wonder if maybe there would have been some nerves heading into halftime, but instead he's cool, calm, and collected, and it's a 2-1 win. I will go back to that yellow card, that opening yellow card, just to say, not trying to take too many shots at the commentator, but he begins by saying, you have to wonder why there's like a yellow card given this early. Like, usually the referee wouldn't let that happen. And then, like, pretty clearly hadn't seen it happen live. Like, maybe had looked away to get a cup of coffee or something. And then gets the replay, and we get that fun moment of the commentator mid confusion about something immediately pivoting to the other side. And it went from, you gotta wonder about that one. Like, it's very early in the game. A yellow card seems premature. Maybe that could have been a red card, though. It could have probably been a red card. How quickly he switched, I did appreciate, even if the game did not devolve into the chaos that I had hoped it might in the opening moments of this one. Still a fun game overall.
Very fun. It's generous, Taylor, that you think the commentator might be having a coffee break 40 seconds into this game, but we'll see about that.
Just getting settled. Just getting situated.
just getting a little, time for a break. We've seen a good 30 seconds of this game already. Cameroon, according to Jonathan Wilson in The Guardian, have an unbeaten home record in competitive games going all the way back to 1973. Which is pretty incredible. They last hosted this tournament 50 years ago. They are five-time winners. The other game on Sunday, Ethiopia against Cape Verde. Cape Verde getting a 1-0 win in this one. Kit Watch, Graham, you have some comments about Cape Verde's outfit here.
Yeah, so this is one of the best kits of the tournament, certainly of those that I have I've seen. I'm not sure I have actually seen all of them. There might be some away kits and so on that I haven't seen, some third kits, but yeah, this is a really nice one. Lovely use of pattern, nice gold typeface and trim. So I might have to try and source this one. Sourcing African kits isn't always easy. You can kind of get Ivory Coast and Nigeria, and I saw Ethiopia in classic football shirts the other day. So it might be quite difficult. I might have to put in the effort, but I think it'll be worth it. This is a beauty, this one.
My one knock on the kit was that the manager was wearing a suit that was almost the exact same color. And so multiple times I kept trying to figure out how they were allowed to have 12 players on the field and why one of them stayed so wide the whole time. And then I would eventually realize that it was the manager. I doubt Ethiopia had issues with that one, but I found that confusing. I also found pronouncing the name of the country we're talking about confusing, because there seem to be a couple different ones. I have always done Cape Verde, and it seems like it's either Cape Verde or Cape Verde, and I don't know how to feel about either one of those things.
Well, Taylor, it does make sense, because Portuguese, I believe, is the primary language in this particular country, and so I cannot be relied upon to pronounce anything that's Portuguese correctly, which I do apologize for, but it's hard to nail that down.
Yeah.
It's tricky. Also, one other thing. Graham talking about finding the kit for... Shoot, well, now I feel self-conscious about how I'm going to pronounce it. Do you want to come to a consensus real quick so I can say this thing?
I think it's Cape Verde if you want to go... Or Cape Verde, if you want to go English, or Cape Verde if you want to go Portuguese, sort of.
I'll go Cape Verde.
This is the Bruno Fernandes principle again, where I've said this for too long in my life. I'm not changing now, so it's Cape Verde until the day I die.
You don't want to go Bruno Fernandes?
No.
Okay. I'm going to say my thing, and then we can talk about this game, darn it. The Cape Verde, when Graham's talking about trying to get a kit for Cape Verde, I just like how he said, you know, it's going to be hard work, it's going to be difficult. Graham, you trying to find a kit sounds exactly like every manager ever trying to prepare for a game at a, you know, like a pregame press conference. Uh-huh. I think you have that tendency. Just shopping for kits is basically your version of African.
Yeah, absolutely. I put in as much effort, as much research and homework.
Obrigado. Coming back to the game, there was an odd moment, Joe. Cape Verde, they had a free kick, they scored from it, but the referee blew up for a VAR check. He ran over and saw the monitor and came back like no goal had been scored at all from the free kick, gave a red card. Then Cape Verde took the free kick again and hit the wall. I was confused by that sequence, Joe.
I was a little bit confused by that sequence as well. There was some interesting VARing in both of these games, really. The VAR screen is satisfyingly far away from the field, at least certainly for the referee, who sort of gets to guzzle down the spotlight a little bit in those particular moments. I'm not entirely sure what happened there, Ryan. It's unfortunate that red card for Ethiopia in this game, who I think are the favorites to finish bottom of this group. They don't have the top-end talent that really any of the other teams in this group do, between Cape Verde and Burkina Faso and Cameroon especially. But nonetheless, I still enjoyed this game. I enjoyed both of these games, guys, so much more than I think I've enjoyed any game in a really long time. Something so fun about tuning in, watching a tournament, learning a lot of things. Maybe that's the thing I enjoyed the most, is getting a chance to learn and to see players and teams that I don't get to watch very often. I don't know. It reminded me so much of why I love soccer. And weirdly, this game more even than the opener. And I can't fully explain why that is, but maybe it's the less heralded names, a lot of the players in this game that I just wasn't as familiar with. Maybe it's Jamiro Montero bossing the game for Cape Verde, which is not really the case, but he did have the MLS assist on the only goal, for Cape Verde in this game. Cape Verde come out in this 3-4-3 shape that usually looks like a 3-3-4 in possession, or a 3-1-6 in possession, with Jamiro Montero and Santos pushing ahead of Borges in midfield. They have depth and they have width in possession. Gary Rodriguez, I thought, was a star. I believe he plays in Greece for his club, but he was making these runs in behind, really providing some depth and some verticality for their attack. And then up front, man, the talent is real in this game for this team. I liked Julio Tavares a lot as this big-bodied nine. He does get the goal in this game to give his team a 1-0 lead. Just so much in this game to like, and it would have been even better without that red card to kind of cool things off a little bit in the 12th minute, I believe. But man, I'm having a blast watching these games, guys.
Well, that blast will continue for about a month, Joseph. There's plenty of games to come in this tournament. Senegal, Zimbabwe happening as we record. Morocco and Ghana are also playing today, and a few others. Why don't we look a little farther ahead and maybe talk about the players we're interested in watching. Taylor, as I mentioned, there are MLS players in here. We've seen Nuhu already. Jonathan Mensah from Columbus Crews here with Ghana. Teenage Adebi from Houston is with Zimbabwe. And then we've got the big names, your Aubameyangs, your Sadio Mane, Salahs, Mahrez, Sebastian Heller, and so on. Taylor, who are you looking forward to seeing in this tourney?
Yeah, there's a couple ones. I'll start with a player that I was not familiar with until I was doing my research. As Joe said, I'm in a similar position of enjoying learning about players that I'm less familiar with or teams that I'm less familiar with. In this case, Odilon Kosonu, the Ivory Coast left back, plays for Bayer Leverkusen. He was one that stood out. He seems to be a regular performer for them. But at 6'3", right-footed center back, who's very good in the air. But the thing that I was noting in watching him is how quickly he adjusts to when he wants to step. He seems to read the game really, really well and has really solid reflexes. So routinely I saw him, both for club and country, stepping in and winning sort of balls into feet and then driving forward with it. So the way he sort of reads the game and plays proactively and then helps kind of win the ball high up the pitch for the Ivory Coast to then continue possession, I think he could be pretty interesting. Another one that I was less familiar with would be Mohamed Kudus, Ghanaian central midfielder, plays for Ajax, but is very young, 21 years old, wears the number 10 for young Ajax when he played for them, does now play for the senior team, but has not played for them since November, got a rib injury while he was on international duty. And I say he's a player to watch if he ends up playing, because he has only just returned to training. Ajax do not think he should have been released, but he is in Ghana's squad, and I think the assumption is that they will give him some time. And then, as because of the expanded format, there's an expectation that they'll qualify for the next round, and that's when you could see him brought in. But watching him play, he is a left-footed playmaker. He can spread the ball, he can find those through passes, he can hit a shot, and I think could be very important for a Ghana team that doesn't have a ton of expectations, isn't in sort of their prime, but I think could spring a surprise with the right combinations.
Graham, anyone else we should look for?
Yeah, so of the big names, the one that I'm most looking forward to watching is Sebastien Haller, just obviously because we've seen plenty of him for Ajax this season. He's currently the top goal scorer in the Champions League, and so I'm interested to see if he can translate that form into this tournament for Ivory Coast. He's a pure goal scorer, obviously, and if Ivory Coast can create the chances for him, then I suggest he'll score a lot of goals in this tournament. The other, I'm going to run through another three very quickly, so two of them are young players, so Hannibal Mejbri, I'm not sure how to pronounce that second name because everyone just calls him Hannibal. He is a player that I have read a lot about. He is widely considered my United's next academy player to come through. He was great for Tunisia at the Arab Cup in Qatar, which was sort of like a pre-World Cup rehearsal tournament. And I want to see him make his mark at this tournament before he makes it big at Manchester United. He's not guaranteed to start games for Tunisia, but I think he could make an impact off the bench. Another young player is Elijah Moriba for Guinea, who he was a breakout star for Barcelona in the second half of last season. I watched a lot of him. I liked a lot of what I saw. I thought he was brilliant. And then he left for RB Leipzig, and we just haven't seen all that much of him since then. So I think he has the potential to be a really great player. So I just want to see him play. I want to see more of him, given that he's not at Barcelona anymore and he's not playing as much. And then the fourth player in total is Stephen Cocker, who is a bit of a weird one because obviously he has an England cap to his name, but he's since switched to Sierra Leone. And just for the novelty factor of seeing a player that we've all watched many times, but now we're watching him in a slightly different setting, that is an interesting storyline to me. So I'm not sure he might not be a player of the tournament contender, but he's someone that I'll be keeping an eye out for.
Joseph Lowry, any players or teams you're looking forward to seeing here?
I'll go more on the team side, I guess, just to give a little variety here. Senegal certainly has to be one of the teams that I am most... It certainly is one of the teams I'm most excited to watch. It certainly has to be one of the favorites of this tournament. They're dealing with a small, or at least it feels small-ish, COVID breakout in their squad right now, so they're missing a couple of really important players in Mendy and in Koulibaly, certainly for the game they're playing right now as we're recording. But man, you look at the talent in that squad. Sadio Mane up top, they have talent in midfield with Idrissa Gana Gueye, they have Cheick Kouyaté. There's so much quality there, especially as you move higher up the field, and still some anchors in the back as well. That's a really impressive team and a really impressive squad that I think is going to do damage in this tournament. They're probably the team that I'm most looking forward to watching. But Algeria's got to be another one, right? You think about the star power they have in Riyad Mahrez. There's talent in other levels of that squad and other lines as well. I think there's a real potential for them to win this whole thing, just as I think there is for Senegal, especially if Senegal can get healthy towards the end of the group stage and into the knockout rounds. I think that could work out really well for them. Algeria is another team I've got my eye on in this tournament.
Taylor, who you got your eye on?
I have my eye on the two teams that Joe just mentioned for sure. Algeria, the reigning champions, returning, I think, 9 of 11 starters from the team that won last time round and have not lost in 34 games, the world record being 37. So we could see Algeria set that world record in this tournament. A team that will try to prevent them from doing so would be Senegal, the runners-up in the last iteration of this competition. To Joe's point, missing some players at time of recording. In the 87th minute, they are in a 0-0 draw with Zimbabwe, who are 101 places behind them in the FIFA ranking. That is probably not how Senegal wanted to start this competition, but I think still will be a strong team, as will Cameroon, the hosts. And then Morocco. I have thoughts on Morocco and Egypt. I think they're both going to be pretty fascinating. Morocco, with manager Vahid Halihodzic, is very much in charge. He has left off key players like Hakim Ziyech of Chelsea, Mazraoui of Ajax, Amin Harit of Marseille. And there was some speculation that that could come back to haunt him, but given that he has 14 wins, 5 draws, only 1 loss in his time in charge of the national team, seems like maybe it will not, and there's still plenty of talent around this team, including Achraf Hakimi, Roman Saïs, Youssef En-Nesyri, who I will never be able to pronounce properly, Nesyri, however you're supposed to say it, and then Munir El Haddadi.
En-Nesyri.
Finally able to play for Morocco, and I'm excited to see what this team can do. Even without some of those stars, I think they will be very good, and I think Egypt will be very good as long as Mohamed Salah is in that team. They've got a lot of domestic players, as we've talked about. They've got some names we know, like Mohamed Elneny and Trezeguet and Ahmed Hegazi. They've got younger attackers as well, and I think watching them play, it's very clear that like Mohamed Salah brings Liverpool to Egypt, and he is playing everything very quickly. It's 1-2 touch, and I remember seeing Egypt without him, and they are a much slower, more sort of route one team. With him in there, it's a lot of quick passing combinations, a lot of quick counterattacks, and just kind of high intensity across the board. A player that is heavily involved in that would be Galatasaray striker Mostafa Mohamed, who's just very similar to Mohamed Salah in what I saw of him, of just running people down, putting that pressure, winning the ball back high up, and then making things happen from there. So Egypt, another team that I think could make a pretty decent run in this competition.
Excellent stuff. And plenty to come from this AFCON tournament. Plenty to keep you, listener, from doing your day job properly over the coming days. We'll take a quick break, a quick water break, if you will. A hydration break. We'll be back with FA Cup and much more shortly.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Today's episode is brought to you by Shopify. On the Total Soccer Show, we often talk about the importance of a manager who can clearly and effectively communicate their tactics and then a squad of players capable of executing that approach, but also adding some individual flair along the way. And that's the same relationship you're getting with Shopify. You tell them how you want things to work or what you need to get done, and they execute the game plan, sometimes even better than you could have expected, with Shopify Magic, their AI-powered all-star. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real store stage, all the way to the did we just hit over a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. From what I've heard from family members who use Shopify for their online store, which has evolved into an amazing brick-and-mortar location, Shopify has helped with that growth, and with every step along the way, they've made it easier to process and track orders, run the business day-to-day, and help with long-term growth as well. So whether you're auctioning autographed jerseys or selling custom stadium prints, both of which are awesome, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, the aforementioned AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States and is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, their extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial at shopify.com/TSS. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/TSS now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. One more time, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/TSS.
Total Soccer Show, we are back. We are talking FA Cup third round. It's that time of year, Graham. Some Premier League teams entering the tournament and some upsets. Why don't we start with one of the biggest ones? Newcastle 0, Cambridge United of League 1, 41 places below Newcastle, 1. Kieran Trippier's debut did not go well for Newcastle here. Newcastle still only won one game this season. Graham, the best stat here is that Cambridge have beaten the same amount of Premier League teams this season as Newcastle have. Wow.
Ouch. That is a sore one. I couldn't understand why this one wasn't picked for TV coverage in the UK, because it quite clearly had upset written all over it right from the start. Yeah, this was a really poor performance from Newcastle. I thought the poorest thing about their performance was the way that they failed to respond after going behind, which it was just feeble. There was no fight, nothing at all. And what this match made clear was they are probably going to need to move for a striker in this window. Obviously, Callum Wilson is out for a long while. I've seen Chris Wood linked, the Burnley striker. I actually quite like that. Because Newcastle have just signed an excellent crosser of the ball in Kieran Trippier, who you just mentioned there, Ryan. So find someone who can finish those crosses and they might be onto something. But yeah, I think this was a reflection of where this Newcastle team is at the moment, and they are not very good.
Hey, Graham, I had a quick question for you. I don't know how his move is advancing or if it is at all, but would Anthony Martial make Newcastle better? Is that a move that you could see them like theoretically going for, in that he wants to leave Man United, he wants playing opportunities, seems like they need a goal scorer, seems like he could fit in there and make something happen?
I mean, he would definitely make them better, but it's not very difficult with that team that Newcastle have got at the moment. I don't think, I would maybe be looking for more of a traditional front man like Chris Wood. Obviously, Martial is a much better technical player than Chris Wood, but just for the sake of getting someone in who, remember when Newcastle were bought over and we said they need to sign players who can get them away from the bottom of the Premier League before they can go out and actually get the world-class players? That is Chris Wood to me. That actually is like quite a sensible signing. So I think Martial likely is on his way to Spain, but he would make them better, certainly. I just think maybe he maybe wouldn't be the front man that they need.
Taylor, the last Newcastle game I watched before this was the one against Man United after the holidays, where they made themselves look rather good against Man United, and then they go and do this. I'm confused. This looks bad for Man United, is my logic there.
I mean, that's fair. I think it probably looks a little bit worse for Newcastle, just because this would have been an opportunity to not slack off, but instead show there is a response. They can fight on multiple fronts. They will have that response that I think Newcastle fans would like to see them have. And instead, to see them not really muster that much, they get the goal that's called back for offside, but that aside, it wasn't a particularly strong performance. It wasn't as though they battered Cambridge, and Cambridge just felt like were able to scrape their way through. Newcastle have plenty of opportunities and had some great goalkeeping. But I also think that Cambridge sort of took the game to Newcastle at times, and I think that is probably not what Eddie Howe wanted to see. And I think once again underlines how much work still has to be done if they're going to stay up and stay competitive this season.
Graham, one more note on this game. Cambridge's kit, Hummel, which I know is a favourite of yours. And the, sort of the pattern on it was like a orange TV test card, like just lines everywhere. What did you think?
Yeah, it was nice. The thing about Cambridge United is, has their badge always been like that, with the big C and the big U? I've never ever noticed that before, and it's a strange one. I'm not sure when that was designed, but it stands out.
Is it stranger than Kieran Trippier being really excited to have Kayak as a shirt sponsor? Did you see that photogram? Because that made me so happy today.
I think he was actually pointing to a tiny, tiny, tiny little Spurs badge that's on the Newcastle shirt this season.
On the Cambridge Photoshop. Badge, Graham, we'd just be glad that it's not the Cambridge United national team. I'll say no more about that one. Chelsea getting a 5-1 win here. Graham, very impressive. 6,000 Chesterfield fans coming to Stamford Bridge for this one. It does show the uniqueness of this tournament, I suppose, and the uniqueness of English soccer as well. Chesterfield being in the 6th division, taking 6,000 fans because the gate system is a little different in the FA Cup, and you can bring more away fans, and the gate is split differently as well.
Yeah, and that is incredible. The depth of English football, I don't think is
matched anywhere in the world. The fact that a team like Chesterfield can take that number of fans to a game. I thought this match in general showed the beauty and the ugliness of the FA Cup. So an upset was never really on the cards due to the gulf between top Premier League teams and lower league teams. And so in that respect, it sort of highlighted how the appeal of the competition is dwindling slightly when the whole competition is sold on upsets and the potential of upsets, and you start a match and you go, there's no chance of an upset here. It does kind of dwindle the appeal. But then Chesterfield got to celebrate a goal at 5-1, and boy, did they celebrate it. Those 6,000 fans went absolutely nuts.
And Taylor, Lewis Hall in defence for Chelsea here.
Yeah, a player that it seems the response has been very calm, very measured, not at all that he is the next great player and should start every single game. 17 years old, involved in multiple goals, had a very strong game. The question is always is, if you can do it against Chesterfield, does that equate to Champions League and Premier League, or will Chelsea need to strengthen in January? I think it would be cool if they didn't. I think it would be cool if they roll the dice a little bit and try to see what happened with Lewis Hall. That said, again, I don't know how much stock you want to put in that one until he has more opportunities and more competitive games under his belt, but a very, very strong game from him. And again, at 17 years of age, you can't ask for much more than that.
Frank Lampard would have rolled the dice, wouldn't he?
I mean, obviously, yeah.
Obviously.
And lost.
Unless it's Jorginho Dest, then get him in there. Let's make that happen real fast.
On Sunday night, Arsenal lost to Nottingham Forest of the Championship at City Ground. Arsenal, Graham, wearing some nice all-white kits, but not playing quite like Real Madrid in those kits.
Yeah, that was the line a number of people... What was it Roy Keane said? They looked like Real Madrid, but played like a pub team, which kind of summed things up quite nicely. I mean, they were super, super slick, those kits, and obviously they came with a great message as well. You know, they weren't just wearing them for the sake of it. 2021 was the worst year for knife violence in London, so 27 teenagers were stabbed to death in the city, which is obviously just shocking, and so the No More Reds campaign is designed to highlight that. Obviously, Arsenal taking the red out of their badge, out of their kit, that obviously showcasing that campaign. Idris Elba was involved in it, and Ian Wright, obviously as a former Arsenal player, was also involved in it. So it was a shame that this match will maybe be synonymous with a cup upset rather than maybe a message that really could use some public awareness.
Indeed. According to Opta Joe, Arsenal were eliminated from the third round of the FA Cup for only the second time across the last 26 seasons. The other time, also against Nottingham Forest. Forest are going to be playing Leicester in the next round. Leicester easily dispatched Watford 4-1. Do we care, Graham?
I'd just forgotten that Leicester were the cup holders, to be honest. 2021 and 2020 and 2019 have all merged into one year for me. So yes, obviously I remembered that they had at some point won the FA Cup. I just wasn't 100% certain it was actually last season. But yes, it was.
Indeed. Let's rattle through a few more of these FA Cup games. Tottenham beat Morecambe 3-1. Morecambe did take the lead in London in this one. Harry Winks scoring nicely from a direct free kick from a crazy angle in that one. Joe, did you know Morecambe are nicknamed the Shrimpers and they have a shrimp on their badge? It's very fun.
Ryan, I love that. I did not know that, but now I feel like I'm basically having dinner at Red Lobster right now, so go on.
They are like a fishing town, and it's a big old shrimp on their crest. It's very, very fun indeed.
I think there are two teams named the Shrimpers, and now I'm a little bit concerned that maybe there's a derby, there's a rivalry that we need to have happen. I'm pretty sure Southend United are also the Shrimpers.
Oh, you might be right.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah, Southend are also called the Shrimpers.
Yeah, so many coastal towns with shrimp in
them. I'm so excited for this. The Shrimp Derby.
The shrimp battle. Tottenham, yeah. There will be no shrimp battle in the FA Cup. Tottenham will host Brighton in the next round. Shrewsbury, if you're that way persuaded, they had the lead at Anfield for 7 whole minutes before losing 4-1 to Liverpool. Roberto Firmino, Graham, scoring a cheeky back heel in that one.
It was a lovely little finish, but my favourite moment in this match was Dan Udo, who scores the first goal for Shrewsbury, doing the... I don't even know how to pronounce it, to be honest. Whatever Ronaldo says when he scores a goal, he does that celebration at Anfield, which was one of my moments of the third round. It's even funnier because Shrewsbury's lead only lasted only 8 minutes. But if you're going to take your shot, you might as well make the most of it while it lasts, and he certainly did.
True indeed, Graham. Non-league Boreham Wood, as you inferred earlier in the show, Graham, they made history reaching the fourth round as well. 2-0 win over AFC Wimbledon. That one was on ESPN Plus, as were many other games. Very nice to see that from my perspective. Boreham Wood managed by Luke Garrard, who was a Wimbledon ledge back in the day in his playing days as well. And also, Ted Lasso was there, and Jamie Tartt, both in the crowd, eating chips. Isn't that fun? Boreham Wood going to Bournemouth in the next round. A bonkers game with League Two's Barrow against the Championship's Barnsley. Barnsley winning 5-4 in that one after extra time with a red card for Barrow as well. That one was cray-cray. And one more game of mention, Taylor.
Yeah.
You wanted to put forward Kidderminster.
Of course, everyone's favorite. Kidderminster with a 2-1 win over Reading. Mostly just wanted to mention them because they will forever be one of those like random clubs that I'm familiar with because they have a connection to Daryl Grove. He played for Halzo in town, and I believe his cousin or nephew, one or the other, played for Kidderminster. So I was definitely pulling for Kidderminster in this one. I'm glad they got the win. And credit to the mighty Boreham Wood. Let's shout their names one more time, even though I guess playing against like sort of amateur opposition, you're expected to get that win. They still did, so credit to Boreham Wood. Credit to Kidderminster.
Serie A, let's move on. Atalanta won 6-2 at Udinese. Udinese were missing 12 players with COVID in that one. Milan got a 3-0 win over the Venice fashion brand. Zlatan opening the scoring after just 2 minutes in that one. Inter Milan, Gren, they stay top with a 2-1 win over Lazio. Milan Skriniar getting the 67th minute win in that one. Did you catch that one, Graham?
I did, indeed. Skriniar has 3 headed goals in Serie A this season from 18 games. That man is just a head on legs. If you put a cross near him, it's going in the back of the net. And Inzaghi's team, he likes to put some crosses into the box a little bit more than Conte anyway. So, yeah, I'm not surprised at all that he's scoring a few with his head this season. I just get the feeling Inter are getting more and more functional as the season goes on. I think there's just 1 point between them and AC Milan at the top of Serie A, but it wouldn't surprise me if they stretch that lead over the coming weeks. They seem to be finding their groove a little bit.
Indeed. We mentioned the chaos in the Africa Cup of Nations, but the chaos trophy for the weekend might belong, Graham, to Roma 3, Juventus 4. Roma giving up a 3-1 lead in this one, missing a late penalty that would have made it 4-4. A De Ligt was sent off with 10 minutes to go for a second yellow, which led to that penalty as well. A quiet first half, Graham, which rather exploded in the second.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this match had absolutely everything. 7 goals, and then it went from 3-1 to 3-4 in 7 minutes. Some of the goals were absolutely stunning, like the Pellegrini free kick. There were red cards, missed penalties, terrible defending. Yeah, this was one of my, not just one of the games of the season in Serie A, this was one of the games of the season in any of the big five European leagues this season. It was so chaotic that it was almost impossible to analyse. The only kind of tactical analysis I can maybe offer is in the second half when it went from 3-1 to 4-3 to Juventus, it seemed like Juventus just kind of pushed everyone up a little bit further. In particular, Locatelli was moved into a more attacking midfield position. Artur was brought on to anchor things in midfield, and that just unlocked a lot of the players that Juventus had on the pitch. And I think it's proof of how Allegri, who was actually suspended for this match, he wasn't at the game, but he kind of has to ditch the negative tactics that they haven't really done much for Juventus this season. And Locatelli is a microcosm of that. He's much more effective he's much more effective being further forward up the pitch. So you get someone in behind him like Artur to anchor things up, you free up Locatelli, and I think that makes a big difference for Juventus, and it proved so in this match.
And at the very least, Jose Mourinho is taking this one really, really with like not freaking out at all, not furious about it. I saw his quote: when we allowed them back in for 3-2, a team with a strong mentality like Juventus, the fear set in, a psychological complex. 3-2 is not a problem for me, but it is for my players. When you're in the S, you get back on your feet. But some players in the locker room are a bit too nice. Feel like we've heard him say that about other teams in the past. And maybe this will be the moment when they kick on and kind of get that level of grit that Jose Mourinho requires. Maybe this is more frustration and could be a frustrating season in the end. Not sure which way it's going to go, but I also don't really fault him when they do sort of concede as many as they did, as quickly as they did, and then their captain and fails to score the penalty in the final minutes. Reason for frustration, I think. Frustration warranted in this case.
So the Italian papers are tearing Mourinho a new one in this day, Taylor. I'm a little confused. He used to be good at defending, and it doesn't seem like this Roma team are very good at defending. They quite often look very clueless. I mean, is this just a reduction in Mourinho's powers? What's going on here?
I mean, you heard him say it. It's the players, not him. He is still a good defensive manager. It's just the players failing to execute his game plan perfectly.
at his last four clubs.
Yep, yep. Always the players. Always the players. Again, I do feel a little bit like, I guess as a manager, you've got to try to like stop the rot when things start to change. And if he could truly see the writing on the wall, maybe should have made some more aggressive changes. But I still think that quote probably, I'm taking it out of context here, and I'm going to put it back into context to say that I do feel like that was a moment of frustration that was valid in my mind when his team goes about losing a game the way they did.
Yeah. Also, bad news from this game, Federico Chiesa has got an ACL tear, so he'll be out for a few months. That's pretty unfortunate for Juventus here.
And Italy as well. They've got their World Cup playoff matches coming up in March, and he won't be available to play, which is bad news for them.
Jerry Seinfeld popcorn shame gif from my perspective on that one, Graham. Roma, by the way, play Smells Like Teen Spirit when they score a goal. Joe, Smells Like Teen Spirit is by a band called Nirvana, who were in the 90s after Parents.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. And can anyone figure out why they play Smells Like?
I saw your tweet, Ryan, over the weekend. I think you believe that, and this is, if you're a club and you have a goal music that actually means something, then that's great. But I don't think a lot of clubs put a great deal of thought into their goal music. And proven by the number of English clubs that have that song that goes I noticed Wigan also play that. Leicester play that. Basically, every team in like the middle of England plays that song as goal music, and I'm pretty sure that means nothing.
Okay, I'll let Roma continue with their Nirvana.
Someone just likes Nirvana, I think.
Maybe they not. Oh, did they not used to play Blink 182? Slightly emo tendencies. Emo Mourinho. Maybe that's it. Maybe Nirvana follows him around. We should look more into that, gents. We're going to take a very quick break. When we come back, we'll talk La Liga, Bundesliga, and any other business. Back shortly.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Total Soccer Show, we are back. We are talking La Liga. Granada held Barcelona to a 1-1 draw. A lovely late goal off the crossbar from Antonio Puertas cancelled out a Luke de Jong opener. Assisted, Graham, by the now returning and now registered Dani Alves, keeping Sergiño Dest out of a job, Graham.
Yeah, that is slightly concerning for the USMNT. I would say that Dest maybe isn't getting as much game time as seemed to be the case at the start of the season. Dani Alves has started the last two matches for Barcelona at right back. He played in the Copa del Rey during the week. And as you say, he contributed the assist from which Luke de Jong scored in this game. And we have seen that as Barcelona, as I've mentioned on the podcast a number of times before under Xavi, they are struggling to score goals, and it feels like maybe they have struck upon something with that connection between Luke de Jong and Dani Alves. So that might be enough to keep Dest out of the team if Dani Alves is putting crosses in like that. He doesn't have the mobility like he used to. Obviously, he's 38 years old now, but he has still got a wicked delivery on him. And yeah, if I'm Dest, I'm slightly worried that my place in that team has disappeared.
Indeed. Garvey getting a red card in this one as well, Graham, in the 79th minute. You know that Pep Guardiola thing of, you know, do lots of tactical fouls in the middle of the field? Are they taking that too far?
Yeah, so that is one of the things that is becoming apparent about Xavi's approach, is that Barcelona are conceding a lot of fouls, and that is becoming a bit of a problem for them, exemplified by what happened in this game. So Gavi, in particular, he picks up yellow cards for fun. He's got 9 for the season, with 2 of them coming in this match. And that proved to be a turning point in this match, because obviously Granada go on to get the equaliser through Puertas late on in this match. So I don't have a solution for that. It seems like you need an invisibility cloak, the kind that Fernandinho has or Casemiro has. Maybe Barcelona need to invest in a couple of those cloaks, but they're not cheap, so maybe not. That might plunge them further into debt.
Staying with La Liga rather than for Real Madrid, for Valencia 1. Real Madrid still on top of the pile here. Goals from Benzema and Vinny Jr. Name a better combo, Graham.
There isn't one. There isn't a better strike partnership in European soccer. Right now, they're as effective and productive as anyone else. And this match was all about Benzema and Vinicius, that just the relationship between the two of them, they are on the same wavelength. Ancelotti has built his whole team around that partnership. And yeah, Real Madrid, if they're going to go on and win the Liga, they're still outperforming their XG by a mile, but with Benzema and Vinicius, maybe that's sustainable. I don't know. They are excellent finishers. One of the interesting things from this game was Dani Ceballos coming on for his first game of the season off the bench, and I thought he was generally pretty impressive. And it just underlines the point I've made a few times about Ancelotti getting more out of this squad, which at this point is probably quite handy for Real Madrid, given that they're not spending a huge amount in the transfer market. So there are players that have come back into that team. Militao maybe being the best example this season. Vinicius Jr. as well has taken a giant leap forward. So Ancelotti is just getting a little bit more out of a squad that a lot of people thought at the end of last season needed a lot of investment.
Taylor, we had England under 15, England under 16, England under 17, England under 18 midfielder Yunus Musah in this game as well. Your thoughts on him?
Yeah, USMNT legend, baby. Except for in this game, in which he played a number of different positions. Sometimes it was like a 4-4-2 with him being almost like a second striker. He had a lot of freedom to roam around, but yes, Benzema was great. Yes, the partnership between Benzema and Vinny is important, but when you completely give the ball away and allow Real Madrid to counterattack a wide-open team, that is not great. That is exactly what happens for the third goal. Pretty much everyone on Valencia's team turned and screamed at Yunus Musah. It was tough to see because I think they were showing us a replay of Madrid's second goal when he gave the ball away. So I think we'll have to do a deeper dive on Yunus Musah on tomorrow's show when we look at some Americans and what they did this weekend, because it wasn't a terrible game from Yunus Musah, but that sequence was pretty rough to watch.
Indeed. Sevilla is still 5 points.
That was
behind
the English in him, by the way. When he plays well, it's the American side. When he gives the ball away to Real Madrid, it's the typical Englishman.
Oh, honey. Okay. Sevilla still 5 points behind Real Madrid with a 1-0 win over Getafe. Villarreal had a 2-2 draw with Atleti. Angel Correa scoring from the centre circle in that one. Listener, check that goal out if you haven't seen it. Later this week, Graham, Wednesday sees the Spanish Super Cup, the start of it anyway, with a Clásico. Barcelona versus Real Madrid and Atleti versus Athletic on Thursday. Those two games, Graham, of course, in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, naturally, and in the middle of the season as well. That's the normal time you would have those tournaments. The Community Shield of Spanish football naturally should be played in Saudi Arabia in the middle of the season.
In the middle of a pandemic. Makes perfect sense to me. Bundesliga. Why don't we start? We're talking about the Rückrunde here, the second half of the season, which started again this weekend. A bad start for Bayern Munich, losing 2-1 to Borussia Mönchengladbach at home on Friday. Bayern unhappy they had to play with 9 positive COVID cases. They conceded 2 goals in 4 minutes in the first half. Ricardo Pepi had a start to German life. Joseph Lowry, and it was a 3-1 loss at Hoffenheim for Augsburg for him. He came on for the last half an hour, Joe.
This debut, first of all, congratulations to Ricardo Pepi, and it's great to see him get on the field for Augsburg and play his first Bundesliga minutes. This debut went pretty much exactly how I think a lot of us could have predicted. He started the game on the bench. He comes into the game in the 60th minute. Augsburg's still down, and they end up losing this game. They end up losing this game and dropping points. But man, he was energetic. He had some defensive pressures. He was fighting for aerial balls. He was a little bit overeager at times with some of his defensive pressures. But overall, some good off-ball movement wasn't played in once, I believe, in the 81st or 82nd minute. Overall, and this is the part that I think we all could have predicted, very few touches, and Augsburg did not score when he was on the field. So it's going to be rough at times watching Pepi and watching this team grow. But still, man, what a milestone for him. What an opportunity for him to continue to integrate himself into that Augsburg team, where I really do believe he's going to play and become a pretty key piece over the next few months.
Did he wear the hat?
No hat, Graham. Thank you for asking, though, because I think that's the most important thing about all this. Until we see the giant cowboy hat, this is all for naught, I guess.
I mean, Graham, it's not very common that players wear hats of any kind when they're playing soccer, to be fair.
I guess just what I've forgotten the name. What was the thing Samir Nasri used to wear around his neck
snood.
Called? A snood. Yeah, just snoods.
Fair enough. That could be a hat if you pulled it up over your head, I guess. Yeah.
I'm gonna go the Ryan Bailey route and say that I think that's the newest content on Graham's OnlyFans is just snoods.
Oh,
only snoods.
Yeah, yeah.
Send snoods. Hashtag send snoods. Anyway, let's talk about Eintracht Frankfurt 2, Borussia Dortmund 3. Two goals in 3 minutes. Two goals in the final 3 minutes. Excuse me, for Dortmund to seal 3.
You're rattled by
one.
The only snoods, aren't you?
I've thrown myself off there.
You're reeling.
Ahead of Jude Bellingham, this one, the great long ranger from Motorhood as well. After Thorgan and Azar started the comeback. A completely empty stadium in Frankfurt. We don't love to see that, but that's what's necessary in Germany at the moment. Taylor, your thoughts on this one?
I am impressed that Dortmund were able to find a way to get back into this one and obviously get the win, and it's a great goal to seal it. I enjoyed Erling Haaland throughout, but I really enjoyed Eintracht Frankfurt for almost all of this game, less so when they ended up losing. But especially in the opening half, I thought they were incredible. I thought the way they pressed, they made Dortmund uncomfortable at pretty much every phase of play. But then, not just pressing, but when they won the ball back, the way they moved it so quickly, it was one and two touch passing. It was really fluid attacking moves. I think they made Dortmund uncomfortable with the ball and without the ball, and that is no small feat. So really, really good job. Really impressive way to jump out to the 2-0 lead for Frankfurt. Less so to let Dortmund back in and ultimately let Dortmund have all 3 points.
Yeah. Graham, can we talk about Dortmund and Marco Rosa? Have we actually seen improvement under him? And we've got to talk about that defending as well, because we know that Dortmund have that in their locker to do some bad defending.
Yeah.
It makes Jose Mourinho's Roma look like a fortress at the back at times. But have we seen positive progress here from Rosa?
That's a very difficult question to answer. Clearly, they have a lot of individual quality, Dortmund, but that's still all I really see from this team at this moment, and that's not what I expected to see from a Marco Rosa team at this stage of the season. Keep in mind, obviously, the winter break has come and gone in the Bundesliga, so this is the second half of the season. I expected a little bit more cohesion from them at this point. So at Gladbach, Rosa's team was always very fluid, but everyone on that side knew what their role was. They were certainly more than the sum of their parts, and I don't fully understand what is happening at Dortmund, because that is not the case at the moment. And having Haaland is just not enough for them. So you mentioned they're the defence, and that defensive basis is just not there at all. And if you look at the second Frankfurt goal, there are 8 Dortmund players in the box and 4 Frankfurt players in the box. Nobody takes control of the situation. There's a lot of kind of miskicks and players slightly moving to the ball but not fully committing to the ball. Now all of a sudden the ball is in the back of the net. And Taylor, genuinely, I don't mean this as a dig at you personally, but it reminded me of watching Manchester United defend. You see a lot of that from Manchester United, and it just reeks of no one really taking responsibility for me in that team. I thought they were better in the second half, and in my eyes, the key to that was getting Thorgan Hazard on for Julian Brandt, and I just felt Rosa got runners around Erling Haaland, so all 3 Dortmund goals come from various stages of transition. Even Daniel Malin, he was kind of used as more of a secondary striker in the first half. In the second half, he was pushed out more to the right, and it just gave Dortmund a little bit more width, with Thorgan Hazard on the left, Haaland through the centre, Malin on the right. But beyond that, I'm not totally sure what changes they made, and that is another baffling thing about this team under Rosa is he's usually a sharper tactical mind, and I saw a tweet over the weekend that it was like whatever Rosa tries tactically just never works in any match at the moment. He has to make changes, and even then it's kind of like a compromise and it's not a full success. So they're a weird team to watch at the moment, no doubt about it.
Joe, can you walk me through how Eintracht Frankfurt did not win this game? It felt like after half an hour they could have been 4-0 up. Plenty of opportunities they created, but somehow got 0 points here. What happened?
I think over the course of this game, Dortmund in this one, I actually don't think, this is a weird thing to say, I don't think they were bad outside of the moments when they were really bad, right? I think they had pretty decent control of the game. They had some nice passages of play in possession in the first half, But then you have Kobel parrying the ball into the inside of the post and into the back of the net. And you have Marco Reus coming back and making mincemeat out of that defensive play and losing the ball. And then Mari scores his second goal in the 24th minute. You have those individual moments, and there's other chances as well that Frankfurt had, although maybe not a ton in that stretch. Dortmund put themselves in the hole. But really, it felt to me like they always had the talent, and they clearly do when you look at the squad, to get a result out of this game. And I think it comes from them wearing Frankfurt down over time. They get Thorgan Hazard on the field, as Graham mentioned. I completely agree, Graham. That was, at least in terms of how the game started to change, a real, really important move from Marco Rosa to get him on the field, to tuck Marco Reus inside a little bit more as a 10 or a left-sided number 8, although I think he was a little bit higher more often, to get just really quality attacking players out on the field and let them run a little bit. I think that was key. And so you get the goal in the 71st minute, you get the goal in the 87th minute from Bellingham, and you get that final goal from Mo Dahoud in the 89th minute. But even there were other moments in that sequence, there were other moments in that stretch, the last 20 minutes of this game, where Dortmund start to look really dangerous. And I would argue, Ryan, to get back to your initial question, that the seeds were there for that early on. When you look at how Frankfurt approached defending in this game and how Dortmund possessed, they started out in this game in a 4-3-3 with Dahoud as the six, and they really were. Dortmund was really owning possession early on against Frankfurt's, I don't know, defensively it looked like a 5-2-1-2. So you have a very narrow and tight front line, a very narrow midfield and width across the back. Because of how narrow that shape was, and because, as I just dropped something off the table here, because of how Frankfurt defended in this game, which was tending to be more man-oriented. They weren't full man-marking, but they were tracking players around. Because of that, Dortmund could pull center backs out. They could pull wing backs out and play in the spaces behind those players. And they did that. They had success doing that early on in this game, and they had success doing it and pulling players out on at least one of the goals. It's the Jude Bellingham goal. Good progression down the right wing. They draw the center back out on that side and play in behind. And Dortmund then lose the ball a little bit in the box, and it ends up being Thomas Meunier who plays a cross in, and Bellingham heads it home. It's those moments that I think the seeds were there earlier on in this game. It just took a while for the ball to actually find the back of the net.
Joe, I'm going to ask the question that every listener is currently asking. What did you drop off the table?
I dropped a pair of headphones off the table. That'll teach you never record with spare headphones or really anything else around you, because if you're me, you're going to drop it on the floor.
That's right. You're all hands in action. That's the problem, Joe. That's the problem. Taylor, Erling Haaland with a yellow card and an assist in this one. Mm-hmm. And I didn't notice this, but you put on the running order that he was talking trash in Spanish at the end.
Yes, he was. It was a fun game from Erling Haaland, who at times looked pretty annoyed in the first half. The second half, I think, was a good motivator. I watched the Mahmoud Daoud goal multiple times to see if Haaland does anything in terms of a screen. He doesn't really. He just gets out of the way. But then in the dying minutes, in the dying seconds, he draws a foul from Rafael Borre and gets a couple kicks. And as he gets up, the mic clearly catches him saying, "¿Qué paso? ¿Qué paso?" over and over and over again into Rafael Borre's face. And his teammates try to kind of push-pull him away. It seems pretty hard to restrain Erling Haaland. And we did have another moment when that goal goes in, the winner goes in for Daoud, that he like tried to be muted about the celebrations, and Erling Haaland was having none of that. So it felt like we got a good sort of a lively performance from Erling Haaland, if not a goal-scoring performance.
You know that "¿Qué paso?" is Norwegian for I respect your professionalism.
Oh, of course,
right?
Of course. Yeah. The mic in this game was doing a lot of heavy lifting, because if you go back and watch the Bellingham goal, I think it's Haaland again and Hinteregger. Haaland goes to get the ball out of the net. There's a shove in the back, and there are some spicy words exchanged back and forth that the microphone picked up. I will not repeat here, otherwise we'll have to add the explicit tag several times over.
Indeed. Well, a spicy game certainly in Frankfurt for Dortmund, getting the 3 points in that one. And the title race slightly tightened up. We shall see how that one pans
it's
out in
happening.
The coming weeks. Graham Ruthven, any other business? Let's get to that. And why don't we go to Porto, where Sergio Conceição, we've mentioned many times that his son plays with his team. He had quite an impact, and there was a lovely moment at the end of this game at the weekend.
Well, you say lovely, but he seemed to be celebrating. So basically, Conceição's son scores the 89th minute winner for Porto against Estoril at the weekend. The celebration seemed to consist of Sergio hitting Francesco around the head as he was kind of holding him close. And I was like, maybe a hug would be a natural reaction to that moment and not some form of assault.
What do you know about hugs, Graham?
That's true. Yeah, maybe that is a hug. Is that what a hug looks like? Just getting hit around the head?
But yeah, it was a cool moment. I think it's fair to say, even if Sergio's reaction was slightly peculiar.
Graham, I thought it was lovely nepotism, personally. Taylor,
actually, I should say this to Ryan. I'll address this to Ryan. Ryan, I think more Seinfeld references for us. I feel like Graham relates to Seinfeld when he's unfamiliar what crying is and asks what this salty discharge is coming out of his eyes. That feels like a Graham Ruffin. Is this a hug? What is this salty discharge? I'm confused.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Well, there might have been some salty discharge in Paris, Graham, with a 1-1 draw for PSG at Lyon this weekend. Not optimal for the Ligue 1 leaders.
No, not at all. And PSG have now won just one of their last five matches in Ligue 1. They really haven't shown much sign of progression over the whole season. They're pretty much playing in the same way they were right at the start of the season, when we all said, well, you know, they've added a number of big name players. Pochettino needs to figure this team out, this squad out. And I'm not totally sure that he has. As I say, they seem to be playing the same match in Ligue 1 over and over again. I did think they were a bit better once Xavi, I always thought it was Simons, but the commentator on my broadcast last night was saying Simons, Xavi Simons. He came off the bench in the second half. He is a teenage midfielder. There's a lot of hype around him. PSG got him from Barcelona a couple years ago. And Pochettino seems to be a really big fan of his. He admitted after this game that Xavi Simons probably should have started this match. He had impressed in the Coupe de France during the week. So he's maybe a player who can perhaps, he's still very young, so I wouldn't count on him too much, but he can maybe give PSG a little bit more cohesion in the centre of the pitch, which they desperately need.
And a final bit of news for this episode. We are in the midst of the transfer window. Joe, did you hear that Toronto FC have made a signing and they've had it confirmed?
Oh, no, Ryan, what's this all about? Some Italian guy, Ryan?
That's right. His name is Lorenzo Insigne. Never heard of him either. He's coming to Toronto. 4-year deal begins on July 1st, Joseph.
It's a big signing. We talked some about this last week. I really enjoyed, and I want to point people to Allocation Disorder from last week with Sam Stajko and Josh Cloak. I thought they did an excellent job of discussing the context of this move, looking a little bit deeper into Toronto's roster and what this salary means and how it could maybe be distributed if MLS was structured in a slightly different way and the roster mechanisms were different. It's just a really good episode. I enjoyed getting to listen to it myself. I would recommend people go check that out. Ryan, to your initial point, I was trying to think, and this is why I responded so slowly. I was trying to think of anyone else that Toronto had signed and make it a bit about that, but I couldn't, which is just really sad. I'm sure there's been at least someone, but alas, I guess it's just Lorenzo Insigne.
That is the big money deal. And you guys, you're the big money deal to me, baby. That didn't make any sense. But Taylor Rockwell, thank you very much for your contributions in this episode.
Thank you, Ryan Bailey. I do have sad news. I'm going to go into mourning. Fatih Terim has been sacked at Galatasaray, and I don't know what to do with myself. I'm going to have a good long walk and stare off into the distance and see how I feel at the end of things.
Start the campaign to get him to MLS. That's what you should do.
I mean,
do.
I think if past is precedent, it will be Galatasaray. Then he'll be appointed Turkish national team manager again, just in time to then be reappointed as Galatasaray manager.
Well, no, wow. Taylor, he's actually got sacked because you and him are going to start your podcast, I thought.
That's right. I mean, I'm down. If he's looking for opportunities, I'm going to have to kind of brush up on my Turkish because, as I recall, his English is not so great.
Brush up on my Turkish sounds like a great podcast name for you and Terim, Taylor. I like the sound of that. Graham Ruthven, thank you very much to you. And I still can't stop thinking about onlysnoods.com.
Me too. Thanks, Ryan.
And Arizona Joseph Lowry, a pleasure as always, sir. Thank you so much for your contribs.
Shane O'Neill. That's another one. Toronto. Shane O'Neill. Boom. Nailed
good.
It.
Some Canuck action snuck in there at the end. Thank you very much, Joe. And listener, thank you very much. We'll be back soon on your feed. Bye!
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC, make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.